Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, April 5th, 2018. I'd like to ask you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's get started with announcements. Redwood Nation Earth First will be having an action camp April 13th through the 16th. Want to do some good for the forest? Help stop, hack, and squirt. Protect oaks and redwoods of all sizes. Join us at action camp April 13th to 16th for nonviolent direct action prep, climb training, and more. It's going to take place near Compche in Mendocino County. For more information and directions, a couple of phone numbers here, 707-937-0627. That's 907-937-0627 or 707-272-8061. That's 707-272-8061. Or you could send email to leftyef, leftyef at gmail.com. Or you could go to rnef.org. You'll probably need some warm all-weather clothes, maybe some rain gear, personal utensils, camping gear, climbing gear if you have it, and your friends and a nonviolent attitude. Camping and training and a meeting space, food, and some child care are provided. Donations are welcome. Music and stories of local forest defense, brainstorming strategies for putting the earth first. No dogs or no alcohol or no drunken dogs. Whatever you think you want to bring your dog or your booze, don't do it. Once again, email to leftyef at gmail.com for the Redwood Nation Earth First Action Camp April 13th through the 16th. And coming up in Alameda County, the Fish Ladder groundbreaking ceremony will be April 23rd. The Alameda County Water District invites you to a groundbreaking ceremony for the Rubber Dam No. 3 Fishway construction project on the Lower Alameda Creek on Monday, April 23rd from 10 to 11 a.m. Come celebrate with the Alameda County Water District as they break ground on this monumental fish passage project, the first of two fish ladders that will provide routes for threatened steelhead trout and other fish to make their way up Alameda Creek for spawning. If you're going to the event, park at the end of Vallejo Street at Alameda Creek, and you can RSVP to publicaffairs@acwd.com. That's publicaffairs@acwd.com. And if you want more information, visit alamedacreek.org. That's alamedacreek.org. And Cascadia Forest Defenders invites you to a week-long climbing camp. Come spend time in the woods April 23rd through the 29th and learn how to ascend and descend a static rope, traverse between trees, use a crossbow for tree entry, build and set a platform in a tree, build road blockades involving aerial structures, and much more. Once again, April 23rd through the 29th, you have to RSVP for a spot and directions to forestdefensenow@gmail.com. That's forestdefensenow@gmail.com. And if you want more information, visit our webpage at www.forestdefensenow.com. And if you want to be a Bird Smart Wind campaign director, they're looking for one at the American Bird Conservancy. If you want to work to minimize impact to birds caused by the development of wind power and associated electrical transmission lines and towers, you could be their new wind campaign director. Please go to abcbirds.org/about/employment/#job-16969. That's abcbirds.org/about/employment/#job-16969. And here's a report back from the 2018 Earth First Organizers Conference, as found on the Earth First Newswire. the 2018 Earth First Organizers Conference and Winter Rendezvous held in February in southern Mississippi was a unique affair. There are things you would come to expect at such an event. Workshops on local campaigns, self-defense, state repression, multiple anti-pipeline actions, attendees from near and far, and an assortment of discussions on environmental and social justice topics. But there was one overwhelming, unifying talking point that many were not expecting. The Red Planet. Elon Musk and his flying Tesla car may only have been featured in the mainstream media for the typical 24-hour news cycle, but the topic consistently derailed the daily schedule of the Earth First Organizers Conference. It may not be cool or radical to be in support of space exploration, said an Earth First OC organizer who wishes to remain anonymous, but we have to get serious about the future of this planet. New holes are opening up in the ozone layer, the oceans are filled with plastic, the last remaining forests are being clear-cut for agriculture, the list goes on and on. But now there is hope for a cleaner, greener future, and it all starts with a mass exodus from this planet. Members of the organizing committee conflict team reported that the Mars debate colored nearly every aspect of the conference, with more than a few arguments getting physical. It was a divided camp, red versus green, Mars versus Earth, said one member of the team. It was apparently on the third day when the schedule was shifted so that a four-hour block could be dedicated to the Mars discussion that the camp finally began to move towards consensus. I was really cynical at first, wondering why I rode trains halfway across the country to fight with a bunch of astronomy nerds, one participant said. But when I heard the science, the rationale behind it, it became harder and harder to argue against. This planet is screwed, and if there is a green way to leave it, to leave all these plants and animals alone, then we'd be selfish not to take it. A Louisiana local and Gil Scott-Heron fan who had never considered the benefits of space travel before going to this organizing committee conference also had a change of heart after the discussion. It's not like Musk launched a Hummer into space, you know. It was a small electric car made by Tesla, one of the most environmentally friendly companies on Earth. Sure, their factories are riddled with human rights abuses, and Musk seems to be a pompous asshole, but that may... abusive, pompous asshole is this planet's only hope. Upon leaving the event, the Earth First groups in attendance signed a pledge to shift focus of their campaigns toward leaving this planet and starting over on a small red one. The pledge is expected to be published online in the coming weeks. We hope you'll add your name to it. Because, as one Earth Firster reflected, we can't dismantle capitalism and patriarchy, but we can at least move them far, far away. And I do want to point out that this article was published on April 1st. Update from the field. The killing season is over. Make way for the next generation. Yellowstone's buffalo trap is finally closed for the season. They have eliminated nearly 800 wild buffalo from the country's last wild herds, mostly through slaughter, but also by keeping some prisoner for quarantine or domestication purposes. In addition, more than 350 buffalo were killed by hunters, mainly in the Gardner Basin, barely a mile from Yellowstone's trap. Almost 1,200 buffalo were killed by management actions this year, and this drastic reduction in the already small and vulnerable population did not even take winter mortalities into account. Today, about only 3,600 wild buffalo remain. Hundreds more may still perish just from natural causes. Yellowstone and Montana had set a goal to kill between 600 and 900 buffalo, all to appease the Montana cattle industry intolerance. Yet even with tribal representations urging a lower kill, they far exceeded that goal. They did so knowing that the central herd is in dire straits. In fact, Yellowstone is so concerned about the central herd, who numbered fewer than 850 this fall, that they appealed to hunters not to hunt in the Hebgen Basin west of Yellowstone, where only the central herd buffalo migrate. No one listened, of course. Wanting to put the conservation burden strictly on hunters, captured and killed hundreds of buffalo in the Gardner Basin, knowing that many would be from the central herd. They just didn't care. They just killed. They took every opportunity to capture and ship to slaughter as many buffalo as they possibly could, all without public support, squarely at the behest of Montana's cattle lobby. The damage they have caused to our national mammal is tragic and unforgivable. And tree sitters in West Virginia aren't leaving, they're expanding in this story from It's Going Down. In the past several days in West Virginia, actions on Peters Mountain have continued against the Mountain Valley Pipeline. On April 2nd, a new tree sit was also launched in an orchard. As news is coming out at a rapid pace, we've created a roundup of recent actions and videos from Appalachians against pipelines and farmland against pipelines. It's now been 1 week since the monopod tree sit was erected on the mountain road in an attempt to stop pipeline construction. This move itself came about a month after an earlier tree sit was made public. As the tree sits continue, residents in the surrounding area, many of which are in the middle of legal battles with Mountain Valley Pipeline to keep their homes, began to rally in support of the resistance and also to send up supplies. In response, police have set up a free speech area far away from the monopod in an attempt to cut off supplies and support, but so far have been unsuccessful in stopping the tree sit and people from mobilizing in solidarity. Tree sitters gave this update on the campaign and the monopod. Good morning and hello from the pole sitter on Peter's Mountain. It's been a week. Sometimes I find it hard to believe. In that time, we've gotten repeated visits from multiple varieties, cops, reporters, MVP employees, and far more importantly, by well over 100 amazing supporters from so-called Virginia and West Virginia, all resolutely opposed to this pipeline. Many of you have brought much-needed gear and supplies. Many of you hiked around 2 miles after the ridiculous Forest Service road closure. Your energy and enthusiasm makes staying up here worthwhile. For over 2 years, MVP has been trying to silence, suppress, and ignore those who do not want to see their water poisoned or the land they love attacked. In the last months, many grew understandably disheartened as state officials refused to heed their calls, federal authorities granted permission after permission, and Mountain Valley Pipeline began cutting trees. Now I'm hearing time and time again how direct action on this mountain is inspiring those people and giving them hope again. I know that people are already taking concrete action. I heard just yesterday about the folks autonomously taking to the trees to defend against pipeline construction in Roanoke County. Who knows what could come next? With people enraged about this pipeline and open to new possibilities of resistance, I'm excited to see what could emerge. I think this could frighten MVP more than any specific work stoppage, that hundreds of people living along the route are opposing the pipeline and are frustrated by a legal system rigged in favor of extractive industries and are gaining hope and energy in this new stage of the battle. No one is going to stop this for us. Together, we can stop it ourselves. I thought I had shared enough photos of cops and workers staring at me for a while, so the image I have posted below is my view of looking up towards Peter's Mountain past the anchor lines running down that side of the road. Sadly, this phone camera does it little justice. Forest Service law enforcement does continue to maintain a 24-hour presence at the blockade, including pulling up the gate and shining their headlights at the monopod overnight and telling ground support not to send food or water. Fortunately, supporters have continued to be able to set up camp right by the blockade. Please come visit if you like, and message the page if you want directions or info on what supplies we could use. And the Japanese whaling fleet has returned from its summer slaughter of 333 whales in this story from Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, Australia. The Japanese whale poachers are in contempt of Australian federal court with a $1 million price tag on their heads and found to be illegal by the International Court of Justice. Their new bogus scientific whaling program does not even have the backing from the International Whaling Commission. In over a decade of Sea Shepherd's Antarctic whale defense campaigns, we have saved the lives of over 6,000 whales. However, a lowered kill quota and double the hunting area, it's time for the Australian government to step up once more and look at taking Japan to the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea, added Mr. Hansen. Another 333 whales have been killed in Antarctic waters while the Australian government refuses to do anything to halt this illegal slaughter. Our Prime Minister has done nothing but express disappointment over Japan's continued whaling program. The vast majority of Australians want action to end this abhorrent whale hunt. The Australian government must not allow this to continue any longer. Legal opinions and the potential to send a vessel to intervene must be looked at in order to stop whaling occurring next summer, said Mr. Hansen. And you can find out more information at www.seashepherd.org.au. That's seashepherd.org.au. Or you could also go to whaledefense.org. And a court has sent the Wolf ruling back to the feds in this story written by Maddie Hayden, a journal staff writer at the Albuquerque Journal. A rule issued by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2015 that expanded the endangered Mexican gray wolf's habitat by millions of acres has been remanded to the service for further revision, a federal judge in Arizona decided Monday. The revision to the regulations for the non-essential experimental population of Mexican wolf describes the procedures for the wolf's release, population area, and management in the United States, but environmental groups felt it did not do enough to save the species. The bottom line is that this rule only gave the wolf a short-term chance of survival, said Brian Bird, director of Defenders of Wildlife Southwest Program. Several groups sued over the rules, arguing it violated the Endangered Species Act and did not provide for the recovery of the wolf. While the rule did expand the wolf's habitat, it also eased restrictions on killing the animals if livestock is preyed upon, capping the number of wolves in the U.S. at 325, and did not allow wolves north of Interstate 40 in New Mexico and Arizona. Many aspects of the rule directly contradicted the earlier recommendations of top wildlife biologists, the groups argued. Among those was a recommendation that three interconnected U.S. populations contain a total of at least 750 wolves were necessary for the species recovery. A group of wolf biologists commented to the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2014, expressing concerns over the way their data were being used. This case is unique in that the same scientists are cited by the agency publicly communicated their concern that the agency misapplied and misinterpreted findings in such a manner that the recovery of the species is compromised. U.S. District Judge Jennifer Zips wrote in the decision, "To ignore this dire warning was an egregious oversight by the agency." Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity said he is hopeful that the new rule will include more of that scientific data. Part of the tragedy of this is Fish and Wildlife was told by some of their best biologists in the world how to do this right, Robinson said, and now they're having to be retold. He also said he hopes Fish and Wildlife Service moves as expeditiously as possible to come up with a new rule. Time is not the friend of the Mexican wolf, he said. There are currently only 114 Mexican wolves in the United States. The Fish and Wildlife Service must now revise the rule and provide the court with a proposed deadline for completion within 30 days of the ruling. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesperson John Bradley said the agency is still in the process of reviewing the court's decision and hasn't determined a specific path forward yet. And coastal rare martens are under high risk of extinction in the coming decades in this story from Oregon State University. The coastal marten, a small but fierce forest predator, is at high risk of extinction in Oregon and Northern California for the next 30 years due to threats from human activities, according to a new study. The study, published in the online journal PIRJ, will be available to federal and state wildlife agencies for their consideration to determine whether distinct geographic population segments of the coastal marten warrant state or federal listing as threatened or endangered, said Katie Moriarty, a certified wildlife biologist and lead co-author of the study. Martens are like river otters out in the woods, Moriarty said, but they can be vicious little creatures, too. When you capture one and it's growling at you from inside a cage, there is no mistaking its intent. They're the size of kittens and act like a pit bull. Some threats to coastal martens include trapping and being hit by cars, said Moriarty, an Oregon State University graduate, now with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station. Martens are trapped for their fur throughout Oregon with no bag limit. This study provides the most conclusive evidence yet of risk to a coastal marten population, she said. It's only the robust population estimate of a marten population in the Pacific states. Martens are rare in the coastal forests of Oregon and Northern California. A different subspecies of martens lives in the high-elevation forests within the Cascade Mountains. Martens resemble a cross between a fox and a mink with bushy tails and large paws with partially retractable claws. Coastal martens were petitioned for listing under the U.S. Endangered Species Act in 2010, but withdrawn for consideration by the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2015. Last year, the U.S. District Court for Northern California denied the withdrawal, and the Fish and Wildlife Service is now collecting information on marten populations for a decision to be made in October. The Martin population is now so small that it is in imminent danger of extinction, which would leave martins without a source population to recolonize the central and northern coasts of Oregon, said Tal Levy, a professor of wildlife biology at the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at OSU's College of Agricultural Sciences and a co-author on the study. Martins once ranged throughout coastal forests throughout Oregon and Northern California's wine country. Extensive surveys revealed that the coastal martin population is now restricted to two populations, one in Southern Oregon and Northern California, and another small population in the Oregon Dunes National Recreation Area west of Highway 101 in Central Oregon. And frogs in Panama are resisting a deadly fungus in this story by Noel Kirkpatrick of Mother Nature Network. A deadly fungus has steadily ravaged the world's amphibian population since the 1980s, but there may be some good news. In a study published in Science, subspecies of frogs in Panama have demonstrated a steady recovery in their population since the citrid fungus arrived in the country in 2004. It offers us all hope, said Jamie Voiles, an assistant professor at the University of Nevada, Reno's biology department, and one of the study's authors. The chytrid fungus works by growing on a frog's sensitive and all-too-important skin. Frogs rely on their skin to perform all kinds of functions, and when it's covered by a fungus, things go very bad very quickly. The reason why this is so deadly for amphibians is that their skin is really a physiological organ, Voiles explained in Wired. Amphibians use their skin to drink water, to take in respiratory gases, and to balance things like electrolytes. Fungus-afflicted frogs eventually die of cardiac arrest. The frogs have a defense mechanism against these sorts of diseases. They can secrete antimicrobial peptides that essentially serve as a kind of immune system to the skin, according to Wired. The fungus is so tough that it overwhelms the frog's defenses. The result has been that plenty of frog species, including clown frogs and common rocket frogs, have experienced severe drops in population. Clown frogs, for instance, are now critically endangered in part because of the chytrid fungus. Voiles and her colleagues discovered that 9 out of the 12 frog species in Panama, for which they have good data, have shown a remarkable rebound in their numbers, however. At first, they assumed the chytrid fungus might be weakening in some way, but then they collected samples. Compared samples collected in 2014 against current samples, and from 2004 when they first arrived in Panama, but the fungus had barely changed on any level. At the outset, I expected we'd find the opposite, that the pathogen had weakened, Voiles said. I was completely wrong. Obviously, something was going on with the frogs themselves. The researchers collected frogs from areas where the fungus has decimated populations, as well as descendants of captive-bred frogs from before 2004. They exposed both groups to the fungus and found that the frogs that lived in Panama were better able to fight off the fungus thanks to skin secretions. While the frogs evolved to combat the fungus is good news, it isn't great news. Evolution can move slowly, perhaps too slowly for a species to survive, especially if the chytrid fungus itself ends up evolving against these new secretions. This becomes especially stark when the 9 species that are recovering represent a mere 20% of the species that originally inhabited the area. We focused on 12 species because we had reasonable numbers to work with, Voiles told the New Scientist. The remaining species may be lost or may still be out there, which is why we need to keep on monitoring. And like human societies, whales value culture and family ties in this story from Florida Atlantic University as found on the Environmental News Network. It might seem like a whale of a tale, but groundbreaking research from the Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute is the first to demonstrate that just like human societies, beluga whales appear to value culture as well as their ancestral roots and family ties. Through a detailed genetic study of kinship published in PLOS One, an international team of collaborators has demonstrated that related whales return to the same locations year after year and even generation after generation. This intergenerational inheritance of where to go and when probably evolves some form of social learning from members of the same species, most likely from mother to calf. The study firmly establishes philopatria to summering grounds and most entirely migratory circuits as a characteristic behavior in beluga whales. Findings from this study also pin down the fundamental structure of the building blocks of beluga whale society and provide compelling evidence that migratory culture is inherited. It further helps maintain demographically discrete populations of beluga whales that can overlap in both time and space. Not only do these whales know where to go and where not to go, they are also passing on this information from one generation to another. And drained peatlands are emitting a laughing gas in this story from the Estonian Research Council, as found in Environmental News Network. A global study led by geographers at the University of Tartu has revealed that drained nitrogen-rich peatlands produce nitrogen oxide, or laughing gas, which degrades the ozone layer and warms the climate. To avoid this, swamp forests, fens, and bogs need to be conserved. Laughing gas, also known as N2O, lifts the mood and alleviates pain. An increase in the laughing gas content of the atmosphere, however, is not a laughing matter. Nitrous oxide is the main driver of stratospheric ozone depletion and is one of the most significant greenhouse gases causing climate change. While the other main greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, have been thoroughly studied, laughing gas is the product of many complex processes of the nitrogen cycle, and reasons behind an increase in its amount are largely unknown. Scientists at the University of Tartu studied the processes related to laughing gas production and established their results in the reputable scientific journals Nature Communication and Scientific Reports. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org at 9 p.m. You can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 in the morning, KBOG 97.9 in Bandon, Oregon, Fridays at 10 a.m., KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. And you can also listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California. You can always listen at radio4all.net. That's radio, the number, 4all.net. You can go there, listen online, or download this or any previous Earth First Update. I'd like to ask you to please have your local nonprofit community radio station air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and to broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening. And please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.